On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It has been a deadly month again for U.S. troops in Iraq. 62 American soldiers dead so far in April. And one of the earliest was one of the many female casualties of this war, Lance Corporal Juana Navarro, 5'2", an angel on earth, her sister said, killed by a gunshot wound to the head in a firefight in Anbar province. A former commander called Juana's death heartbreaking, but the rolls of war dead in Iraq brim with the names of women: Amanda, Tina, Tricia, Ramona, Keisha, Kimberly, Lorianne, and many more. All dead. The front in Iraq is everywhere, and more than any war in American history, women are in the thick of it. Up next on Point, Women at War in Iraq. Joining me first today from Washington is Ann Scott Tyson, military reporter for The Washington Post. Ann, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I wish you'd just start off telling us the story you've written about Sarah Pirro, Captain Sarah Pirro, and the kind of work she's done not so long ago in Tal Afar. Give us one example of an American woman at war in Iraq here.
Well, Captain Pirro is just an incredibly respected helicopter pilot. She flies a Kiowa Warrior, which is one of the few positions women can hold, which is a real combat position and authorized to be that way. She was flying in Tal Afar, a northern Iraqi city that had been overtaken by insurgents last year, and the conditions were so intense that they would take fire literally every time they flew over the city. But she was, again, extremely professional. No one in the unit questioned her capabilities and judgment. And on one mission, for example, the aircraft was almost shot down by heavy insurgent fire over the city. She managed to fly it back to the base, with a compromised fuel tank and sort of a cracked structure to the helicopter. Took about 10 minutes to ready another helicopter and flew directly back into the battle.
And give us a sense of just how intense this is. This isn't at 30,000 feet. This is in a relatively small chopper that's right down above the streets, giving support from a 50 caliber gun and rockets to soldiers right there on the, I mean, this is in the thick of it.
Exactly. Their mission is to work directly with the ground units. And interestingly, when I interviewed Captain Pirro, and there are actually four females in her small unit, they chose that job because they knew it was that mission of working directly with the infantry and armored units, and giving them the autonomy also to be out there, be scouting out. They will, curve around a building and spot fighters who the infantry on the ground cannot see, try to walk them in to where those fighters are, or attack them directly if ordered to.
9% of women in the Army today are aviators, as you describe. In Iraq overall, lots of women in support positions, but the battlefront is everywhere, and lots of them really close to it. Give us a broader sense, if you would, Anne, of the kind of jobs that are putting female soldiers in the U.S. military right up by the explosive front of this war.
Well, a lot of those include military police. In Iraq now, the work is a lot a policing role. So the female MPs have oftentimes been based in Iraqi police stations, which have come under heavy attack, for example, out on patrol with Iraqi police, some of the most heavily attacked units in Iraq. Civil affairs, who do work directly and interface with the local governments there, are very much on the front lines. For example, there are women who, because they're needed to search and frisk Iraqi females, they will accompany infantry on raids. That is about, as close to the, front lines as you can get.
When the door gets knocked down, they're right behind the troops going in.
Uh-huh.
And they have taken casualties. Now, the numbers are released in all different kinds of paces and ways here. I'm looking at the latest from iCasualties.org. Shows a total of 2,391 U.S. military dead in Iraq, and I'm seeing a number of women somewhere north of 50 at this point, with another 370-plus wounded, some very seriously.
Yes. So there have, definitely been wounded women with, amputees and that sort of thing, and also women medal earners. You know, there has been a Silver Star awarded to a woman who served in Iraq, a military police woman who was involved in a very heavy ambush and, fought very valiantly, as well as other awards. So they're, not only victims of the conflict, but they're, again, proving their capabilities.
I'm quoting you here, Anne, saying that Iraq has taken a proportionally larger toll on servicewomen than in any prior U.S. conflict. Is that still the case today?
Yes, that is, because, again, of the numbers and the different positions that they're serving in, there were a number of new positions that have been steadily opened up to women, although there still is a policy that bars them from serving with infantry, armor, special forces. And they're also not, according to the Army, they're not supposed to be co-located with those units. But again, the nature of the conflict in Iraq, you can be in any type of unit, particularly the support units, the women driving trucks and being out on the roads every day is one of the most dangerous places you can be in Iraq.
So they're at the front, whether they're supposed to be there by policy or not. There has been quite a debate back in Washington over the last year about this expanded role and exposure for women. How's that been resolved? There were some pretty tough strictures proposed, but as I read you, Anne, they haven't in the event gone through.
No. What happened was there was an effort, primarily by the House Armed Services Committee, to sort of restrict women from moving into any new positions, and some early legislation that they proposed would have, in fact, barred women from about 20,000 positions they're currently serving in. This was, interestingly, of course, it was a Republican initiative, but it was openly opposed by the Army, and in the end, by Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. And so that did not happen. However, they did put existing policy into law, and they also required a report that was supposed to come through in March but has been delayed just having the Defense Department review its policy on women, make sure it's complying with the law, and that's underway right now. So I guess you could say that there is additional congressional scrutiny of the matter, but no real rollback, although critics will say that even the fact that this is going on sends sort of the wrong message to women at a time when the services are having difficulty recruiting.
Do you think we've seen a permanent sort of forward evolution in the role of women in the U.S. military? Has Iraq, is it cementing this? Are women just going to be closer to the front and taking more casualties?
Well, certainly the sense I've had being over there from, male and females, including, male officers, is that this is just the way things are, and they're very focused on simply accomplishing their mission and, the secondarily only, if at all, thinking of the gender of the person, in a serving next to them. So yes, there are political sensitivities, but I think that the consensus on the ground is that, the reality is sort of just gone well beyond these sorts of debates.
It's a whole new day. Anne Scott Tyson at the Washington Post, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Joining me now from Arlington, Virginia, is Captain Dawn Halfacre. She was platoon leader in the 293rd Military Police Company attached to the Army's 1st Infantry Division in Iraq from February to June 2004. On June 19th that year, she was severely injured when a rocket-propelled grenade exploded inside her armored Humvee when she was on a reconnaissance patrol in Baqaba, Iraq. She lost her arm. Captain Halfacre, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So you've been back a while. You paid a big price. What, as you look on at the women in Iraq today, what do you think about the role they're playing there?
I think that the role the women are playing in Iraq is sort of evolving, and is like Anne said, it's something that is just being done, and the other soldiers over there aren't really questioning the gender of the people doing the missions, and the focus is on just getting the mission done. And I think the women are stepping up and performing brilliantly over there, and they're they're doing a variety of jobs, and like I said, they're just adapting to the different missions that they're given, because like we said, this is there's really no front lines and you know, women are being co-located with units that they would normally be serving with. And mm-hmm. example of that is I had a female gunner that I had to send on a few missions with a special forces team because they were short on people and needed somebody to operate a 50 cal. And mm-hmm. they said, give me your best 50 cal gunner. And I gave him Private Rose, who happened to be a female.
And off she went. You told, I think it was the Washington Post, Captain Halfacre, that one of the toughest things is getting your hair in a ponytail. That's with one arm, that's got to be difficult. How do you talk with women stateside now? You've counseled women at West Point and elsewhere about what they're looking forward to. What do you tell them about what to expect from a military career?
It's a great career, but it's certainly not something that's for everybody. And you know, the women who are interested in pursuing a career right now, I mean, pretty much any job you go into, you know, you're likely to get deployed and you're likely to possibly face combat. And so I think that it's just important that they understand that is a possibility. But you know, the training and you know, the efforts to prepare us for these jobs and for what we might face are actually, I mean, in my opinion, they're pretty much on target. And I think especially West Point and certainly any ROTC program, you know, they're taking the great lengths to bring in speakers like myself or just anybody with combat experience or experience leading soldiers or being a soldier, whatever the case may be. And so I think that you know, I encourage them to go forward and accept the challenge and do their best.
What do you think about remaining restrictions by law on the role of women in war, Dawn? Do you think they should stay? Do you think they should be further loosened? Where are we headed here? Should there be a distinction between men and women in battle or not?
That's a very loaded question, and you know, I've thought about it briefly, but having been a soldier, it's really something like, you know, I was a military police officer, and I understood my mission, and it was, you know, whether I was a male or a female, just it really didn't matter, and you know, it was just the fact that I was going to get the mission done. But I guess, you know, looking at it more broadly, I think that it's hard to change the language, you know, the way Congress has written these rules is governing women in the military. You know, it still says, like they discussed earlier on the show, it still says that, you know, women are not to be on the front lines and not to be in certain jobs, but, you know, we are working, doing those jobs, but maybe not in that capacity directly. You know, we are going on raids, things like that, things that you would associate with the infantry. But, you know, military police are doing those along with a variety of other people. So, you know, I am not one to, you know, I wouldn't want to be in the infantry. I would not want to be in an armor officer. But certainly, you know, not to say that women who want to do that should not be able to. I mean, honestly, I think it's more of a personal thing for me where, you know, I was comfortable with the role and just the fact that there were rules out there, you know, basically stating that we weren't to be doing what we are doing over there. It's a fact. Women are involved in combat. You know, it's just like, well, they either need to change the rules or they're not going to change them, and we're still going to continue to do what we're doing.
Yeah, I have to say, I feel like we're straddling something here, even myself. I mean, what you describe and others going on in Iraq is a very heavy daily engagement in situations of great risk that you and others have come to take for granted, that you paid a significant price for, but you're standing up like any other soldier and taking that price back here stateside. I'm not sure people's mental image of war has caught up with that. What's been your reception since you've come home and come home with this injury? How are you received by, you know, sort of family, friends, people you don't know when they learn your story?
Well, overall, I've had a lot of support personally, but I can definitely say people are very, very surprised. A lot of times, you know, people maybe from an older generation or the Vietnam generation, they've been great at sort of reaching out to me and to other people, and, you know, making sure that we don't have to go through what they went through. But as far as being a female, I think a lot of them work hard to try and relate to me, but it is certainly obvious that it's a foreign concept to come back. And, you know, to have women who have literally, their bodies have been altered physically, you know, physically bearing the scars of war, if you will. And I think that you are certainly right with when you said that society has not really caught up with this. And I don't think it's their fault. You know, this is a new idea, but it is happening. And, you know, we are proof that women are in combat. And so, you know, like I said, it's just we're definitely straddling something. It's like we either change the language or we just don't worry about it and move on and continue to do our mission. I mean, there's, you know, from a soldier's perspective, from my perspective, there's really nothing I can do about what Congress, you know, says. It's, you know, but I'm given my mission and I go do it. So
it sounds like that language is floating a little apart and above reality right now,
exactly,
as you describe it.
Yeah,
Captain Halfacre, if you'd stand by for just a moment, I want to welcome another voice into this conversation from Washington, Sergeant Kayla Williams. She was a sergeant in the 311th Military Intelligence Battalion of the Army's 101st Airborne Division. She is also author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. Kayla Williams, thanks very much for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
What was your experience like in Iraq? What is it like to be a woman soldier in this fierce situation with no clear front line today?
I think that combat is difficult for everyone. Being in a combat zone is a challenging experience. I felt very lucky in that I spoke Arabic, and that gave me a different perspective that's unusual for any soldier in Iraq right now and allowed me to speak to the local people. But it was very frustrating to eventually realize, especially the longer that we were there and the more that pressures built up on soldiers, that although, of course, they did regard me as a colleague, the male soldiers that I worked with were always very aware of the fact that I was a female. And knowing that that was always sort of a subtext became very frustrating. It's difficult to know that your actions reflect on all others like you, and conversely, that if any other female made a mistake or had a failing, that I would to some extent be held accountable for her actions as well. And that was an added stress of being in an already difficult situation.
You've written about a couple of subtexts there. I mean, the one is, I guess, capacity. The other is sexual. There's been any number of reports of sexual harassment. These are close quarters and tough circumstances. In Iraq, is it capacity or sexual harassment? Which that sort of draws this subtext most clearly for you?
It's difficult to untangle sometimes. For example, what I might have considered sexual harassment here in the States, those lines became very blurry when we were in Iraq, especially being co-located with combat arms units. Male soldiers who aren't used to working with females very frequently, and watching how they interact with each other, which is very different than the way that I think most civilians are used to, and realizing that if they interact with me in the same way that they interact with each other, even if there are sexual jokes involved, mm-hmm. is that sexual harassment or is that being included in the way that they treat each other? And it becomes very difficult to untangle. But it can be very difficult and challenging to cope with at times. I eventually realized that if I were too friendly or outgoing, that would be misinterpreted as an invitation to a relationship of more than just a friendly nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it eventually served to make me somewhat more withdrawn and more professional, which would then get me labeled something else entirely.
We're going to hear later in this hour from a mother whose daughter actually went AWOL because she couldn't take the sexual harassment in Iraq. And, I mean, this is an incredibly tough environment. Kayla Williams, Don Halfacre, stand by. I want to begin to invite our callers in here. Steve is calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I wished to ask your guests about the idea of having strict and total gender neutrality, which would translate into total gender equality. By that I mean women shouldn't have the choice of a combat or non-combat role. Like men, they should be placed where the military needs them. If that means combat, so be it. Equality of opportunity means equality of obligation, equality of risk. No distinction to the extent biologically practical.
So you're saying let's get away from the old historical thing of protecting, what, women and children from danger, certainly women from war. If they're in it, be in it.
Absolutely. And none of this reporting in the newspaper, a helicopter crashed, 10 soldiers were killed, including two women. It cheapens the lives of male soldiers, and it diminishes the women as well. It should be just 10 soldiers, and then you can give their names and let people make a decision themselves.
Steve, we've got it. Captain Halfaker, what do you say to that? Is it time to go gender blind on military service, or is that too much?
Well, I think that's sort of what we talked about earlier, where in some cases it has. I mean, when you have to do a mission, you go out and do it, and you don't sit there and question, well, wait a minute, you know, this, am I in compliance with policy, or no, I am a female, and I'm going out on this mission, I'm going to do my job. And, you know, I think it's an important concept to base it on military need.
Steve says, look, there's no difference biologically or any other way, he says, and so let's just put women as we're in this far, let's go all the way. Let's put them wherever troops are needed. Gender be ignored.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly when you're over there, the enemy or the insurgents, however you want to refer to them, they're not discriminating. I mean, they don't look and say, oh, you know, that's a female, I'm not going to shoot at her or whatever, obviously. Mm-hmm. I went through that. But, you know, in my opinion, I mean, there are certain biological differences between men and women that one could argue, you know, women cannot perform to the same physical standards, which, I mean, in some cases, women have already, you know, proven that they can.
Yes.
So, you know, they would have to open up some of these jobs for women. But, you know, that's a tough question. And I think that right now we are on the forefront of, you know, strictly basing with the jobs we are already allowed to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is based on military needs somewhat, whether that's acknowledged, you know, by the people who are writing our policy or not.
So de facto, we're getting awfully close. I want to invite another voice in. Carol Burke joins us from Irvine, California. She taught for 7 years at the Naval Academy from 84 to 91. She's now an assistant professor of English at the University of California, Irvine. She's author of Camp All American. Carol Burke, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. I'm happy to be here.
You followed American women in the military for a long time. How would you describe the significance of the forward step we're seeing in Iraq? What's new? How would you define it?
Well, as both your other speakers have already discussed, women are being put in new roles. I just want to correct something that I think was a misstatement.
Yes, please.
At the beginning of the hour.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that the current war has seen more sacrifices of women than other wars. In fact, in World War I, there were 36,000 women serving in the armed forces, and 400 died in the line of duty.
Yeah, I think that was a line from Ann Scott Tyson with the Washington Post,
yes.
And I don't have it in front of me now, but here it is. A proportionally larger toll of service women dead in hostile fire. Now, I mean, in all of Vietnam, I think there was one in that category. 8 women dead in total. Of course, much larger numbers of women in other wars, World War II certainly. So we get into some semantics here, but we take your point.
Sure.
And yet you're hearing described a role that most observers are saying is not a role we've ever seen overall in Iraq, played by American female military.
Certainly. And the women who are going in on patrol, not on patrol, excuse me, are going house to house, ferreting out insurgents with infantry soldiers is a new role for military police to play. That's not to say that military police women haven't faced combat situations before. They have in Panama and have demonstrated themselves with distinction there.
Let me take a call from Maureen in Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Maureen. You're on the air.
Hi.
What do you know, Maureen? What have you seen?
My daughter is currently in Iraq, and she's an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And she is doing convoys to move construction equipment from one location to another.
Mm-hmm.
These missions are so dangerous that they can only be conducted under the dark of night. There are no facilities for the women soldiers to go to the bathroom. It is very hot there, and in order to stay hydrated, they need a lot of fluids, but she's not even able to drink fluids because there's no place to use the bathroom because it's too dangerous.
It's dangerous in what terms, Maureen?
Hostile
fire makes it dangerous?
A roadside bomb. Mm-hmm. One of her soldiers was killed 3 weeks ago by a roadside bomb.
And what do you see in this? War's hell, and are you proud that she's at the front and doing what men do, or does it seem inappropriate to you as a mother?
It's highly inappropriate to me to put my daughter in this situation.
How does she feel about it?
She's scared to death. Their lives are on the line every minute that they're there. They say a prayer every time they have to leave their station to go out on one of these convoys. And their soldier died because there was no medevac helicopter to come and pick him up while they were out in this convoy.
It's rough, and we hear it, and we wish your daughter very well, and we wish you some comfort of mind, Maureen, as you wait for her to come home. Dawn Halfaker, we just have you for a little bit longer. What do you say to a mother like Maureen about the service of women, of her daughter in this conflict?
Well, it's hard for me to... You know, I don't have any children of my own, so it's really hard for me to know what it's like. I mean, I know what my mother went through when I got injured, and, you know, it was very, very difficult.
Captain Halfaker, thanks very much for being with us. We've been joined from Washington by Sergeant Kayla Williams. She served in Iraq. She's the author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. From the University of California, Irvine, Carol Burke is with us. She taught earlier for 7 years at the Naval Academy. She's author of Camp All-American, Hanoi Jane and the High and Tight, Gender, Folklore, and Changing Military Culture. And right now, from Eugene, Oregon, by Sarah Rich. She is a member of Military Families Speak Out. It's an organization of people who opposed the war in Iraq, who have relatives or loved ones in the military. She's mother of Suzanne, who was a military police officer in the U.S. Army in Iraq from February 04 to February 05. Suzanne was scheduled to redeploy, to go back again to Iraq in January. Instead, she went AWOL. Sarah Rich, thank you very much for joining us. Why did Suzanne go AWOL?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Suzanne was packed and ready to go. She was, about to go. She had her car keys in her hand, and she turned to me. She said, Mom, I just can't do it. I just can't go back there. Because when she was there, she was very isolated. There was no way for anybody to be able to help her with the sexual harassment that was daily, if not hourly, when she was in Iraq. So for her to go back to that place where she felt so vulnerable, and so, she was being hunted, it felt like, at times by, you know, predators that were out to either sexually harass her, sexually assault her, have sex with her, or rape her.
Hunted by her own fellow military men.
Out of all the men that she encountered, there was one sergeant, her direct, her unit leader, who did not do anything and was never inappropriate with her.
Where did she serve in Iraq, Ms. Rich?
In Karbala.
Kayla Williams, Karbala. What do you make of this story? Here's a young woman, Sarah's daughter, who felt so hounded on this difficult front that she just couldn't face going back. She went AWOL instead.
I find it very disappointing that her chain of command would have let her down that severely by refusing to deal with the situation. And, of course, I can't know what actually happened or what, if anything, they did do or attempt to do or whether or not she reported it. But certainly the military has a lot of structures in place to try to help soldiers if they need to report things that are going wrong, and there are methods that you can take to try to deal with the situation. And what I found most difficult was not actually the fact that sexual harassment does happen on a pretty regular basis. I was able to develop a thick skin and be able to respond to it fairly well. What was frustrating to me was the attitude from a lot of my fellow soldiers who were male, that if I chose to report something that was completely out of line, that they felt as if that was a betrayal, instead of thinking that the soldier sexually harassing was betraying me and all soldiers by inappropriate behavior. That sort of peer pressure to not report, the peer pressure to just laugh it off, it's just a joke, just deal with it, that I found very frustrating. But the times that I did choose to to pursue complaining about behavior that was completely inappropriate, which was very infrequent for me to do because most of the time I could just blow it off,
mm-hmm.
I did find the response that I got from the system to be very appropriate.
Mrs. Rich, did your daughter try and report this up the chain of command to get some relief?
She saw other soldiers, other female soldiers do that, and what happened to the male offenders was that they were promoted and moved to another unit. Finally, when she got back to the States, she actually did report something that happened that was inappropriate, and the sergeant was actually, she saw him being moved to another unit, and he was promoted.
AWOL means she faces, I guess, jail time if she's caught, is that right?
That is right.
So that's what she took as a preference to heading back. What's your message to the Pentagon command here, Sarah Rich?
Well, my message is, you know, I've heard a number of your guests today talk about the evolution of the armed forces and how women are being incorporated. Well, it's time to get with the times and find different ways of holding people accountable for treating people as human beings, not as sexual objects. And I'm sick to death of hearing about all the women that have been abused, raped, molested, and died over in Iraq because they didn't feel safe as women in the military.
Sarah Rich, we wish your daughter, Suzanne, good luck. Hope she can find a better circumstance, and we thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Sarah Rich joined us from Eugene, Oregon. Her daughter, Suzanne, has gone AWOL rather than go back for a second tour in Iraq. McKinley's calling from Webster City, Iowa. Hi, McKinley. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess I'd like to say a couple of things. I served in Iraq and Afghanistan. I was a non-commissioned officer in military intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and I had female soldiers work for me the whole time I was over there in both places. A couple of things. One, as far as the, you know, what I hear a lot of these numbers about rape and all these things that are happening to female soldiers abroad, and that did not happen where we were at. We took very good care of our soldiers, and like the other speaker was saying, the sexual harassment, it just sometimes it happens, I don't know what you can do about that, but as far as being raped and feeling in danger from your own soldiers, that didn't happen.
As a male soldier in Iraq and Afghanistan, with female soldiers shoulder to shoulder with you, did you feel that these were your full colleagues, well supported? Were you glad to have them there? How's it working?
I think that there are some problems. In Afghanistan especially, we would go out for 18 or 20 days at a time, and that means no showers, and they were getting yeast infections, urinary tract infections, some real problems as far as that concern goes. And then one of the ways that the Army judges physical fitness is by how many push-ups you can do, how fast you can run 2 miles, how many sit-ups you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these women soldiers could do more of that than I could. But when you get into carrying 100 pounds of gear, you throw in body armor, batteries, food, water for several days, radios, ammunition, you're talking about carrying around 100 pounds of gear, maybe, up and down mountains. And some of these women, even though they can do more push-ups and sit-ups and run faster than me, weigh 110 pounds, 120 pounds. They're just not physically capable of it.
Do you feel then, McKinley, that women are being pushed too far forward in the U.S. war effort today or not?
I really do. I believe in equal rights in a workplace, you know, back in the United States. But I think that in some cases, we're just asking more than they're physically capable of.
Carol,
and there are certainly a few women who stand out and they're different. But 99% of women just aren't capable of some of these things.
Carol Burke, what do you say to that? You've watched the role of women over a long time. Here's McKinley. He was a sergeant in Iraq, Afghanistan. You hear his view. What's your response?
Well, I think that let me link it to some of the other discussion as well. I think that the military is going through a cultural transformation, and it has, in this war, inherited a past of a masculinist tradition, and now women are serving beside men, and what is very, very slow to change is the notion that not only some people in the military still hold dear, but also civilians outside of the military,
mm-hmm.
that in some ways the military is an institution that confers manhood on its members. And so you have this, in the worst commands, what becomes a kind of cult of masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that women can't perform in certain situations because as a group they might have, generally upper body strength that's less than men, does not recognize the fact that some women are stronger, even in terms of upper body strength, than the weakest men.
So judge it case by case.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Kayla Williams, let me put the same thing to you. I mean, 100 pound, the weight of a 100-pound pack hasn't changed. You hear McKinley's concern. Do you share it? Do you think women are too far forward today or not?
I do not think women are too far forward. I was out on the side of a mountain without access to showers for months at a time and never got any sort of infection. The bathroom issue that a caller mentioned earlier can, of course, be an annoyance, but certainly is something that can easily be worked around. In terms of some of the other physical issues, such as the fact that it is, yes, much more difficult for somebody who weighs 100 pounds or 125 pounds to carry a 50 or 100-pound rucksack than it is for somebody who weighs 200 or 250 pounds, that is an issue. But that's an issue for men who only weigh 125 pounds also. And there are little guys in the Army, too. And the DARPA is aware of this as an issue. They're working on lots of things to carry more gear for soldiers.
So new
soldiers
technology, kind of exoskeleton technology we've seen. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And I saw recently, and I think Popular Science, a pack dog that can carry a robotic kind of dog-shaped machine that will carry things. So this sort of problem of carrying hundreds of pounds of gear is an issue for everyone. It can be more of an issue for some people than others. Since women do tend to be smaller, it can be marginally more of an issue for us, and that is a frustration. But I don't think that should be used to prohibit women from all situations, but maybe to institute guidelines that are more reasonable, where if you're going to be in a job where you have to carry X amount of weight, X amount of distance, then that the ability to do that in that particular role should be applied across the board to men as well as women, because certainly there are men who are also not able to do it.
McKinley in Iowa, thanks for calling. I want to get a call from North Carolina. Mary Ann's on the line. Hi, Mary Ann, you're on the air.
Hi, sir. I currently came back from Iraq as well. I'm a sergeant in the Marine Corps, and I basically just wanted to say that I was actually kind of distressed when I heard that that Congress would limit our combat experience. We, as women, if we're put into a situation, we knew that situation would arise when we signed the contract to serve in the military.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go into the military thinking that I wouldn't, you know, I would sit at a desk. I didn't go into the military thinking that I would be filing papers. I went in knowing that I would be a Marine. I went in with that expectation. So I think that as a woman going in with that expectation, then you should be able to adapt to any situation that you're put into.
Marianne, did you find yourself treated equally? Did you find yourself treated respectfully in war in Iraq?
Yes, I did. I also understood what she was saying. When these men interact with each other, they often interact with them with each other in a way that women don't really interact with other women the same way. So you have to kind of judge that and decide, you know, if you want to be part of this or not. And that's something that you have to decide yourself. If you feel there's a situation that is going past your comfortable zone, then you should just leave and move away from that situation. That's often sometimes what you had to do, and just make them aware that you were no longer comfortable, and they often stopped or, you know.
Yeah, no, we hear it, and good for you. If you muster that kind of command, that's terrific. And we thank you for your call and for your service as well, Marianne. Thank you for calling. Carol Burke, I think, you know, riding behind all this, and maybe it's just old-fashioned now, but there was for a long, long time, of course, a sense that women be kept from, protected from sort of the worst of war. Do you now see that as just an old-fashioned, sexist view of life and gender, or not?
Well, there certainly were cultural expectations in previous generations that women should not assume certain roles in the legal profession, for example. Mm-hmm. Very few women judges, and for a long time women weren't partners in major law firms. All of that has changed since the 1970s and expanded both educational opportunities for women and professional opportunities. I just wanted to comment a little bit on the expectations that are placed on women in terms of excluding them from certain roles. If you look at, if you take tanks, for example, if you've ever been in a tank, what you realize instantly is that the kind of person, the kind of body that's needed inside a tank is small, mm-hmm. strong, and nimble, mm-hmm. not a beefy linebacker. Mm-hmm. But women, in fact, are precluded from any kind of service. And I know a woman who went through an ROTC program, really wanted to be a tank commander. That's completely off limits to her. Simply not because she couldn't do the job, simply because of her gender.
Kayla Williams, I want to put the same question to you. Maybe this is just old-fashioned thinking today, but not only for the protection of women, but, you know, we talk with many members of the armed services on this show, and we're reminded that, you know, military soldiers are trained to kill. And I think, in part, this may be a cultural reluctance to see women in that way as trained professional killers. That's what tanks do. That Carol Burke would put a woman right there. Do you see that as old-fashioned and sexist to have some reservation about that?
I do, and I think that things are starting to change. You see more women as police officers now than there used to be, and I think that's a similar type of thing. I do believe that it's a sexist relic from an older time, and we've seen in some of the in some other parts of the world that women can certainly be killers in military situations and have no hesitation. I, of course, hope that eventually humanity reaches a point in general where nobody has to be put into this role. But at this point in time, I think that it's only reasonable that women who want to join the military, who want to serve their country, we do go in knowing that we're joining the military and that we are not joining as in roles where we'll never carry a gun. That's what we signed up for, and we should be allowed to do it. I know that Congress does not currently allow for us to be in combat jobs. I know that the military is an old and large institution and is resistant to change in a lot of ways. But I really have high hopes that this war, when more and more soldiers, male soldiers, are serving alongside women, seeing us as professionals, watching us help accomplish the mission and be a valuable part of the process. I hope that this will go a long way towards paving the road for greater change in the future. Mm-hmm. The generation of leaders that's coming into the military now will grow up seeing women more regularly and be better able to institute change as they get into higher and higher leadership positions later.
Well, it is a new war and a new day, and you lay it out very plainly for us. Sergeant Kayla Williams, author of Love My Rifle More Than You. Thank you very much for joining us today. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
And Carol Burke at University of California, Irvine, author of Camp All American. Ms. Burke, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.